Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. We've got a great guest here for you today. He's the Dickison Professor of the Humanities at Stanford University and one of the most interesting and flexible historical thinkers you're going to find anywhere in the world. He's also the author of several books, most recently The Great Leveler, Violence and Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century, which was one of the most thought-provoking books I've read in the last few years. He's got a new one coming soon, and it's entitled Escape from Rome, The Failure of Empire and the Road to Prosperity. It comes out October 15th. It's a fascinating book with really enormous implications for how we look at the world, and I highly recommend it to all of you. Professor Walter Scheidel, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Well, thanks for having me once again.
So let's start with the basics here. Escape from Rome, it's a big book, but its argument is really pretty simple. The end of the Roman Empire and the lack of empire in Western Europe more generally was the necessary precondition for industrialization, sustained economic growth, and the eventual hegemony of the West. So in the absence of hegemonic empire, Europe had the competitive fragmentation of power, which produced and sustained that growth. Is that pretty much right?
That is absolutely right. There are two phenomena here to talk about. One is that if you look at empires, of course, there's the Roman Empire in Europe, but it goes away and it never comes back. And if you look at other parts of the old world, any zone where you have sufficient population density, the right ecological conditions for large-scale state building, empires keep coming back. They come and go in East Asia, in South Asia, in the Middle East, in North Africa. But post-Roman Europe for 1,500 years is a major exception in that respect. And that produces one type of fragmentation, which is political polycentrism, that there's a state system that becomes more and more established, more and more durable over time, leading up eventually to the modern nation states. The second type of fragmentation is that Europe isn't just splintered among many different states. Societies, states are also fragmented within domestically. And I draw here on a concept that Michael Mann, a historical sociologist at UCLA, came up with in the 80s of the four main sources of social power: ideology, economy, military, and politics. And in many states, these different types of power would be pretty tightly bundled together, controlled by the same elite groups. If you look at your quintessential medieval European state, for instance, those sources of power are quite autonomous. You have kings who nominally wield political power, but don't really have the ability to boss people around and make them do lots of things they don't want to do. Military power rests often with knights in their castles or later on mercenaries for hire. Economic power is often held by merchants in independent or autonomous cities or city-states. And ideological power, of course, was captured for a very long time by the Catholic Church. And these different constituencies all compete for influence. They're often in conflict, but they also have to enter compromises. They have to bargain openly to get anything done. And as a result, the kind of political system, economic system you get in Europe in the post-Roman period looks more and more different from what you see in other parts of the globe. So you have double fragmentation, and it's that double fragmentation over a really long period of time that ultimately provides a fertile ground for genuinely transformative change in the economy, in knowledge, in any number of things that we have seen over the last 10 generations or so.
So this project is something you've been working on for years. I mean, we talked about it back in our first interview. That was more than 2 years ago on my old show, Fall of Rome. So what drew you to this particular topic and why does it matter?
I've been thinking about this for at least a decade, and I think it started out when I compared the Roman Empire and early Chinese empires. And I started thinking, well, is this related somehow to what historians call the Great Divergence, the fact that Western Europe started pulling away from the rest of the world about 200 years ago? There's a very big debate whether this process has deep roots going back 500,000, 2,000 years or not. And I thought, as a premodern historian, I was pretty well positioned to intervene in that debate. And initially, I was skeptical. I thought, unlike many of my immediate colleagues, I think maybe early history isn't really all that important ultimately. But over time, it became clear to me it really does matter. If you want to understand why these transformative changes happened, where they did, when they did, we really have to understand the deep background as well. And so I got drawn into this debate, and what I ended up is a book that's much longer than I thought it was going to be, but I hope it's a useful contribution to this debate.
The Great Divergence is a really fascinating topic. It's one that gets a lot of play, but not so much among historians. I mean, among economists, sociologists, political scientists have been very concerned with that. Historians seem to have kind of left it behind. Why do you think that is?
That is absolutely true. On the one hand, I'm very happy that social scientists have engaged with this because I admire their approach and I've benefited a lot from the analytical rigor that they show in their work. At the same time, it is in a way pretty sad that historians have more or less abandoned this topic, which I think is part of a larger trend that many, not all, needless to say, but many historians have turned away from really big questions. And that's just part of a larger shift in academia. It is unfortunate. I think what we need is more cooperation between economists, political scientists, historical sociologists on the one hand, and trained professional historians on the other. So I'm trying to redress the balance a little bit by bringing a historian's perspective back to this question.
Yeah, it's an important thing. I mean, I'm something I'm very concerned with myself at the moment. I too am writing a book that at least deals tangentially with the Great Divergence. And like, it has been incredibly valuable for me to read the social science literature on that, to read the economists, to read the economic historians, and to try to understand how they're approaching these questions. And it never ceases to amaze me how much there is to offer there and how historians could, if they chose to do so, could grapple productively with that. And it's frustrating that they have not.
I fully agree. In fact, we are lucky that there are economists out there who take an interest in early history, because 99% of economists don't. So we are really fortunate that there are enough economists to actually work on these questions. And I agree, we can greatly benefit from that.
Doing good economic history, I mean, you've done economic history for a very long time. Economic history is hard because it has to be both good history and good economics. And finding people who can do both of those things to a high level of quality is not an easy task.
That's certainly true. And that's why I said cooperation. Not that I actually cooperated when I did the book. I mean, I talked to economists, but I think the next step would be more sustained actual cooperation in producing scholarship. And it's difficult to do because of boundaries between departments and different expectations of, you know, tenure committees and that sort of thing. But in the end, that's really the best way forward. So I hope one way or another, this is going to happen more in the future.
Yeah, I mean, well, projects like the one that you've produced here certainly speak to the possibilities of that kind of cooperation. So let's take let's take a little bit of a step back here. Empire is at the heart of this book. How do you define an empire? And how was Rome typical of empires? How was it unique?
There are about as many definitions of empire as there are historians of empire, so it's difficult to be precise. Most people will think, well, an empire is a very large state, which is sort of true. There are some defining features that I think matter most. One is that empires usually consist of a core region, a center, where the people who did the conquering, who did the empire building initially came from. And then there are subjugated peripheries out there. And the bigger an empire is, the more diverse these peripheries will be in terms of language, ethnicity, religion, culture, mode of subsistence, you name it. And that's not something that ordinarily troubles the people who rule empires. In fact, they often actively celebrate this diversity. The more diverse my empire is, the bigger a ruler I am. So you have these very large entities that look very imposing on modern maps, where a lot of physical space is filled in a particular color. But, you know, if you look at the actual setup, often these empires are quite brittle. The governmental apparatus is very limited compared to what we are used to. They rely very heavily on delegation, on cooperating with entrenched local elites to get things done. And they may have very little effect on the daily lives of most of their subjects most of the time. So if you define empire in this way, the Roman Empire was completely typical. It conforms very neatly to this template. Mature Roman Empire, very large, has a clearly defined center that shifts over time, but there is a center. It consists of about 2,000 autonomous cities, almost like subordinate city-states. Most of the money goes to the capital city or to the military. Centralized governance is very limited, and most affairs are local. And in that respect, Rome is not atypical. In some details, it differs from other empires, but that's really unavoidable.
So is the question I have about Rome kind of in a global sense is, as far as the ways in which it was divergent, is the presence of those cities or the reliance on cities as kind of basic administrative units, does that stand out at all?
Well, it's not a reliance on cities. If you look at the Han Empire, for instance, which existed at the same time at the other end of Eurasia, it also consists of about 2,000 cities. The difference is that the cities are somewhat less autonomous. Okay. They're run by salaried civil servants, by bureaucrats who are picked and employed by the central government, whereas the Roman cities run themselves. Now, on the ground, I don't think the difference on a day-to-day basis wasn't all that big, but overall, you could say probably makes a difference. There's a stronger tradition of local autonomy in the large parts of Europe that were controlled by Rome, and maybe a bit less of a tradition in, say, East Asia. And that's maybe why empire is more durable over time in East Asia than in Europe. But overall, I think the Roman Empire isn't really all that different. And the one thing that makes it really different, which is that it had a very large standing army that's really expensive and was probably bigger than it needed to be most of the time. Well, that goes away and never comes back anyway. So that's not a very durable phenomenon with respect to later historical development.
Yeah, because I'm trying to think here as we're discussing this about things that might contribute to that later landscape of fragmentation and things that make it different. And so the locally focused aristocracies in Roman cities might be one piece of that, and the way in which kind of later barbarian conquering elites fitted themselves into those existing aristocratic networks, that might be one piece of that. But still, in the grand scheme of things, that doesn't stand out that much.
No, because that's quite typical. When empires fall apart in other parts of the world, that's exactly what happens, right? You have conquerors, new people who come in, and they either displace or merge with the existing elites. And that has to happen at the local level. That's really the only way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So empires in general, benefits and drawbacks. What are some of the benefits to economic growth? What are some of the drawbacks?
Well, it depends very much on what you mean by economic growth. Mm-hmm. Traditional agrarian empires are pretty good at promoting or protecting a particular type of economic growth, what economists would call Smithian growth after Adam Smith, who felt, well, you can have productivity gains with division of labor, expansion of the size of the market that you produce for, orderly conditions, rule of law, security, all of this lowers transaction costs, as we would say today. And that promotes economic activity because you can make more stuff more efficiently, you can trade it more cheaply, more safely over longer distances, and that generates a certain degree of economic growth and contributes to welfare. The problem is, from our perspective now, there is a limit to this. This kind of growth does not normally result in genuinely transformative innovation in the institutional or technological sphere. And if you look at history overall, it so happens that whenever you have instances of transformative innovation and growth, it tends to happen somewhere else. Not in these large empires that try to maintain the status quo, but in, say, city-states, if you think of, you know, late medieval Renaissance, early modern Italy, for instance, where city-states come up with new kinds of banking and public debt and a bond market and a number of exciting things that didn't exist before, they are really sources of genuine innovation. So it seems that empires are pretty good at fostering traditional, slow, limited forms of economic growth, but they are not very good at fostering transformative growth, which is what ultimately got us to where we are today.
That's a really fascinating point because, again, Rome would seem to be the case study of that, that all of the things that people like about the economy of the Roman Empire, if you take the maximalist position of the Roman Empire's economy, which seems to be getting more to be kind of the standard view as the archaeology gets better and as we get a better understanding of kind of the trans-regional integration of the Roman economy, that things like information transfer, technological transfer, diffusion of ideas, especially the importance of peace as a way of making sure that you could do large-scale transfers of bulk goods from region to region, the role of the state in terms of providing a baseline level of demand for goods and providing transportation infrastructure. The Roman Empire would seem to be the case study for what those kinds of baseline benefits for empire can be in terms of integrating widely dispersed territories, allowing for regional specialization. Rome would seem to be a pretty good case for that. But your point that you're making here is that there is a hard limit to what that can do.
It seems to be. And all the things you just described apply to China, to various Chinese mm-hmm. dynasties over time. And people have always wondered, you know, you have all these cities, you have economic growth in Song China, for instance, or in later periods. Why is there never any genuine breakthrough in terms of innovation, institutionally, technologically, in pre-modern China? Why does it happen in Europe? And you could say, well, the Roman Empire, if it had existed forever, or if it had come back in a similar format, it would have shared the experience of China. There is no good reason to believe things would have gone very differently. And you can look at the Ottoman Empire, you can look at the big Indian empires. It's the same story over and over again. You have a limited amount of growth. You run into Malthusian constraints because population also grows in response to this limited economic growth. And eventually, returns and inputs are going to fall. Crises are going to occur. You see this systematically in Chinese history. There's some evidence for this also in the Roman case. It's a cyclical kind of development, but you never have any genuine transformative growth as a result of this.
So let's turn the clock back a bit. We have the Roman Empire emerges in Europe. It was not a given that empire was ever going to emerge there, but Rome did. You pinpoint military mobilization and war in general as the key factors in creating the Roman Empire in the first place. So what was it specifically about Rome that was conducive to that?
So as a Roman historian, the most honest answer I have to give you is, strictly speaking, we don't know, right? Because the Romans set up their system of military mass mobilization at a time when there are basically no sources. You have Livy writing hundreds of years later, but how would he know? Mm-hmm. So technically, we don't know. If we take a few steps back and we look at this comparatively, it becomes far less difficult to explain. If you look at the Greek city-states or other small-scale communities in Italy, in the Mediterranean at the time, they all tend to have pretty high levels of engagement, of mobilization of the adult male citizen population in the political sphere, all the way up to democracies, and certainly in the military sphere, that it is customary for farmers to go out and fight for their polity. And that's pretty easy to organize in small-scale, face-to-face societies where people feel more they belong to a meaningful entity. It's easier to mobilize or shame people, to incentivize them into participating in these kinds of activities. So in that respect, what happens in Rome is by no means anomalous. But Rome stands out is in its ability to scale up. It's easy to do this on a small scale. It's much more difficult to get several million people all over peninsula Italy to do the same thing, to serve in the Roman legions or the allied auxilia, which is what the Romans accomplished by the 3rd century BC. That's much more difficult to explain. And that's why it would be so helpful to have better evidence to shed light on this process. So we're really reduced to conjecture. You could say, well, maybe it's the political dimension. People aren't just soldiers. They are citizens, they feel part of a republic. Well, most people probably never even got to Rome physically, except for the military levels. Very few people participate in actual elections. Many more men would have served in the military than would have ever voted in a single election. So there is some detachment of the military from the political sphere. Same is true of the religious rituals that happen in the city of Rome. Most people out in the towns and villages of Italy, their main contact with the Roman state would have been to serve in the military, which sort of begs the question, what, you know, motivated them to show up faithfully year after year? That's something actually rather difficult for us to explain, something that Roman historians tend to just paper over because they think they know or they are uncomfortable with the fact that they don't really know, but it's a really striking phenomenon. And historically, something very, very hard to replicate, which we see in early modern Europe when emerging nation states try to impose generalized conscription. It took hundreds of years, a great deal of effort to actually make this happen. This is very rare historically.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And it speaks to, I mean, historians have had lots of debates about this, the extent to which Rome was at all atypical of Mediterranean states in the scale or intensity of its war making. I mean, you come down pretty hard and I think pretty convincingly on the side of the fact that Rome was unique, even among what was a warlike Mediterranean context, that Rome still stood out in the sheer number of men that it could mobilize, in the constancy of its war making, that it was every year. I mean, you pinpoint only a few years over the course of hundreds of years where the Romans were not actively at war with somebody. I mean, that's pretty convincing evidence to my mind.
I hope so. I mean, you know, pre-modern states are at war all the time, but not quite as assiduously and not quite on the same scale as the Roman Republic. So there is something a little bit special about Rome. It's not totally unique, but it's sufficiently different to succeed where others did not.
And as far as why so many people were so willing to do this for so long, it's in the we just don't – we have good evidence for – you know, the kind of Roman aristocratic viewpoints on these things. And it's basically, you know, everything revolves around, you know, success in war as a means of promoting social standing. But that doesn't tell us why your average farmer would be happy leaving his plow behind to go fight in Macedonia for 3 years.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, as we understand very well why members of the Roman elite would do this, because for glory and enrichment and career enhancement and so on. But I have no idea why farmers did it. We have the same problem, though, with the warring states in China, where you also have very large infantry armies without any kind of republican system, and they show up in very large numbers and die in very large numbers too. And again, we only have the elite viewpoint that considers this to be somehow a natural kind of thing to happen, but we can't look into the heads of the people doing the actual fighting. So there are real deficiencies in terms of the sources that we can't ultimately overcome. No new sources are going to appear to tell us why this happened the way it did.
Yeah, that's true. It's, and as valuable as recent archaeological discoveries have been in terms of fleshing out kind of our understanding of the material circumstances of early Republican Rome and Italy at that time, like, this archaeology is not going to get you inside the head of one of the people who was out there doing this, unfortunately.
No, I doubt that. It's really about ultimately people's mentality. Of course, once the system is in place, it's self-sustaining, right? You have a culture of military participation and mobilization, and each new generation is socialized into that system. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think continuities are really important. And it's arguably easier to build up what the Romans built up if you bring together hundreds of small communities that are already individually warlike, right? So the basic preconditions are already in place. And then the remaining challenge is to make them all cooperate under Roman leadership, which is maybe easier to do than to start from scratch, because most societies are much more polarized, right? You have a ruling class that collects revenue, you have professional warriors, and you have a civilianized population of taxpayers, of farmers and merchants who hand over tax and rent, but they don't fight. And if you start out with that, it would be much more difficult to establish military mass mobilization from scratch. So in that sense, the Romans had it easier, but not very easy, because how do you really get all these people to fall in line? That's the big question that's still with us.
Yeah, and it speaks to one of the kind of enduring questions about Rome in general, which is, why does it last for so long? How do you sustain these kinds of cultures and institutions over the course of centuries and centuries and centuries? I mean, even as you point out in the book, even Gibbon said that like one of the truly amazing things about Rome is not that it fell, it's that it lasted as long as it did in the first place.
Yeah, I think he got that absolutely right. Yep.
He was a perceptive man. So we're going to take a brief break, and then when we come back, we're going to turn to the question of Rome's fall and the long-term effects of that.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like, every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
And we're back. So I don't want to focus too much on this because the book is about so much more, but you deal pretty directly with the question of Rome's fall by saying it happened. You know, historians have spent a long time arguing about this, especially over the last 30 years or so. Do any of the arguments about fall versus transformation hold any real weight for you, or are they simply outside the purview of the book?
I take an almost perverse delight in my book to say, well, we shouldn't worry so much about the fall of the Roman Empire. Empires generally fall, right? Mm-hmm. Every agrarian empire in history fell apart at some point. So let's not get all too excited about, you know, the causes of the fall of Rome. As to the question about whether the empire fell, yes, it did. But we just mentioned Gibbon before. Mm-hmm. I always say to my students, maybe Gibbon had it backwards, right? He wrote a long history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And I think, in a way, the Roman Empire fell before it declined. It mm-hmm. fell apart in the 5th century AD, and then most of the eastern part fell apart or was taken by others in the 7th century. But it took imperial institutions of governance, of fiscality, urbanism, elite culture, hundreds of years to fade away, to erode over time under the Germanic successor regimes that were set up in what used to be the western half of the empire. Once you reach the year 1000, most of these institutions are pretty much gone, with the exception of the Catholic Church, if you think of it as a Roman imperial institution, which is a bit ambiguous. But everything else is gone. So you have the political disintegration first, and then the erosion of imperial institutions, both of which matter to my story. We need empire to formally end, but we also need Roman-style governance to end in order to create an environment that is significantly, strikingly different and then can provide different conditions for economic growth, innovation, and so on in the long term.
Yeah, so it's one of the things I've always thought is really fascinating is the extent to which, especially all the way up, I would say pretty much until Charlemagne, you're living in the shadow of the Roman Empire in Western Europe, and the way those institutions, even if the things that they're doing bear no real resemblance to their Roman predecessors, the names stick around. Like, it's all of these constant echoes of a past that no longer exists. That's why I always think Charlemagne too is a pretty striking breaking point, because when you can conceptualize things in terms of renewal, of renovatio or something along those lines, then you've hit a breaking point. Then you're when the past is distant enough for you to conceptualize yourself returning to it in some radical form, then you're doing something different. You're doing something fundamentally new and different.
Well, there's certainly an irony in this, that exactly at the time when these so-called Roman emperors return with Charlemagne and then the Ottonians, the Roman Empire has really gone away, and nothing they do restores anything like the Roman Empire. So the more they talk about it, the less legacy there is of the Roman imperial system.
Yeah. So you run very systematically and logically through the points at which something like the Roman Empire could conceivably have returned. It's one of the things that really stands out about the book is the extent to which you systematically go through counterfactuals, something I wish historians did more. So you go through Justinian, Charlemagne, the Ottonians, then when you get to the Ottomans, then you get up to Napoleon and so on and so forth. Of those possibilities, did any of them have any real potential for returning something like the Roman Empire?
As far as I can tell, the answer is no. Let me get back, though, for a moment to the question of counterfactuals, because that's very close to my heart. As you said, you wish historians did more of this. Well, they do. That's the underlying paradox. If you're a historian, you do any kind of scholarship that rises above the level of mere antiquarian description. You make any kind of statement about causality. You say factor A was important in bringing about outcome B. When you do this, you already automatically engage in counterfactual reasoning, because you say, well, if factor A hadn't been there, if it had been different, then outcome B would also have been different. You may not be aware that you're doing this, but you do it every single time you make some kind of historical historical argument. And that's why I find it so amazing that professional historians are often actively opposed to the use of counterfactuals.
Oh, I got a very stern talking to when I was doing my dissertation about the question of counterfactuals and even about addressing causality in a grand sense, that there was some real discomfort with the project that I was doing with the nature of talking about causality that way.
It is truly amazing. And of course, counterfactuals are very common in the social sciences, among political scientists in particular. And that's where I got my inspiration from. It's true there are bad, playful counterfactuals out there, you know, the men in the high castle, that sort of thing. They are fun, but they're not academically rigorous. What I try to do is take a leaf out of the book of the social scientists and employ counterfactuals that are realistic. You can't employ counterfactuals meaningfully that would require historical actors to do things they would never really have done in real life. Everything has to fit the context that exists at the time. And that brings me back to your question. If you do that, if you try to identify critical junctures between the fall of Rome and Napoleon, at which something like the Roman Empire could maybe have returned on the same scale, a similar kind of durability, if you try to approach this in a controlled fashion by only considering counterfactual outcomes that were likely to happen at the time, well, there aren't really any obvious occasions when something like this could have happened. And I spend a lot of time on this in my book because I think it's really important. You find in the literature sometimes statements, well, the Arabs could have conquered Europe in the 8th century, or Charlemagne's empire could have lasted, or the Mongols could have taken over Europe, or, you know, Philip II's his armada could have conquered Britain, and everything would have been different. Well, some things would have been different, but not everything, because all these things are embedded in long-term structures and developments and so on, and you have to take account of this. So I try to do this. Counterfactuals are always speculative. They can never be perfect, but they are useful. And so, in a way, I think I identify 8 possible junctures. The most interesting one, in a way, were the Mongols showing up in the 13th century. They're interesting because they are so good at conquering other places, all of China, the Middle East, really far away places. And you could look at a map and say, well, if the Mongols could do this, why couldn't they also have conquered Europe? Europe is in pretty bad shape in the 13th century. It's highly fragmented. It's not very powerful militarily. It's, you know, it's pretty fragmented, obviously, there are all kinds of problems. It would have been a very promising target for the Mongols. And I spent a fair amount of time trying to explain why, no, it wasn't really a plausible outcome for any number of reasons. And that's interesting in itself, because if you could identify occasions where things might just as well have turned out differently, you could say, well, maybe it was just by chance that nothing like the Roman Empire ever comes back. But if you can never really find an occasion where this was a likely outcome, then history that actually happened becomes much more robust, that the outcome of long-term European fragmentation is a robust outcome, much more robust than what you see in other parts of the world. And then the next question is, well, why was it so robust? And that leads me to look at geography, at ecology, which people have been talking about for hundreds of years, going back to Montesquieu and so on. And again, most historians today would be quite uncomfortable with this because they are scared of what they call geographical determinism. Well, I'm not a determinist. Nobody, no sane person would say geography determines historical outcomes, but it's not irrelevant either. It shapes condition in a way that makes certain outcomes more likely than others. And that's what I'm interested in. And if you pursue this systematically, you see there are very good reasons to believe that Europe is just not as well suited to hosting very large empires than other parts of the world, including, I should say, Eastern Europe, where you have very large states, Kiev and Rus, the Lithuanian Empire, the Russian Muscovy, the Russian Empire over time. But Western Europe is ecologically, geographically not very well suited, which is something it has in common with Southeast Asia for the formation of very large imperial states.
Yeah, it's one of the things that really stands out about the book is your sensitivity to the interactions between multiple different kinds of causality. Right. So you talk about not being a geographic determinist. What you're interested in is the way in which those geographical constraints or the geographical context interacts with multiple other factors at any given point in time. Right. So
I try to do that, which is obviously very difficult in practice. And I'm sure it could be done better. But I think that's the only reasonable approach if you want to say something meaningful about long-term history.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
Yeah, so let's get to the big kind of $1,000 question here. How did political fragmentation drive long-run economic growth, transformative growth of the kind that produces the modern world?
It probably doesn't drive it directly, but it helps it and helps sustain it by creating the right framing conditions. Mm-hmm. So if you have a great deal of fragmentation between states, within societies, that opens up spaces that may not be available in other kinds of regimes. Spaces, for instance, for commercial capital, for merchants who are not tightly controlled by some military or political elite, but they can do things on their own. They get away with more things, they can try out more innovation, they can invest more safely. And if things go bad in one place, well, they can move, or capital can move to some other place. And we see this in European history. If you think of persecution of Jews, for instance, or people who have the wrong flavor of Christianity, they can always go somewhere else. And they fertilize the economies of the places where they end up. So this kind of polycentrism is really important. The Republic of Letters that develops in the early modern period, where you have scholars, learned people communicating with one another, competing, collaborating with one another across boundaries, that's another facet of this particular process. If you get persecuted in one place, if conditions aren't quite right, well, you just go somewhere else. There's the flow of new ideas cannot be as effectively restricted as it could be in a large politically unified space. And so very gradually, over time, these multiple fragmentations that I talked about earlier, they create an environment that makes it easier. It's still difficult, but they make it easier for transformative change to occur, for groups to prosper who do things differently in ways that eventually lead to genuine breakthroughs.
It's a really fascinating thing. So I've been spending a lot of time on the world around 1500 for the purposes of the book that I'm writing. And a lot of it is about this particular critical juncture. The world around 1500, that is a point of pretty explosive change in a whole bunch of different ways. One of the things that stands out to me is how widespread throughout Western Europe a lot of institutions and mindsets were at that point. So you get a certain kind of unity in diversity. You get this extreme fragmentation in a way that's hard for us to understand in a day and age of pretty uniform rules and laws across fairly large and bounded geographic spaces. But you could do business in very similar ways in Bruges and Venice and in Valencia and in London and in the cities of the Rhineland. Pretty much, if you wanted to do business, if you wanted to trade, if you wanted to buy and sell, if you wanted to make things, you had access to very similar kinds of public order institutions across a large space. Things that were going to guarantee property rights, that were going to guarantee that if you made a loan, you were likely to get some return on that, that you could work in the same kinds of interest-bearing tools if you wanted to make loans, that there were lots of commonalities all across this space, despite the political and institutional fragmentation in other regards.
That's certainly true. And I have two answers to this. One is, after 1500, you get something called the little divergence, that all of a sudden parts of Europe become somewhat more different, the Netherlands, England in particular. And if you want to do novel things in a certain way, you have to go to those places. Yes. You can't do them equally well in Portugal or Italy or somewhere else. But it's true that even at that time, later on, there is still a great deal of cultural, civilizational unity in Western Europe. And that takes me full circle in a way. In the book, I spend 500 pages talking about the significance of fragmentation. At the very end, I come to the question, well, was it a good thing that Europe was fragmented but had a shared heritage of ultimately Roman culture, Roman institutions, Latin as an elite language, Christianity, which is the most important output in a way, if you will, of the Roman Empire long term? And the answer is quite possibly. If you have extremely intense fragmentation where people cannot communicate easily across boundaries, they can't migrate easily, they can't transfer capital easily, that would have made it much more difficult for European economic growth to take off. So to have a baseline level of uniformity superimposed on a great deal of fragmentation, that seems to be like a Goldilocks scenario. Mm-hmm. And that happens literally just once in the history of the world. It would have been very difficult to replicate anywhere else.
Yeah, it's very difficult, I think, to find a kind of an analogous scenario to late medieval Europe where you have extremely dense commercial networks and ideological networks that transcend political boundaries in quite that way. It's really hard to find something that is all similar to that.
I think that's true, and if especially if you look at other parts of the world.
So turning things around a little bit, after a project of this scale and ambition, you've now done two huge ambitious projects back-to-back between the Great Leveler and this. What are you turning your attention to next? I'm really fascinated to know what you're going to tackle.
Well, I'm going to take a little bit of a break.
Well-deserved.
So this project itself, when I was done, I thought, well, okay, so I tried to provide an explanation or add to existing explanations to the biggest question in history. I think the biggest question in history is, how came the modern world to be the way it is over the last generations or so? That's a genuine transformative discontinuity. And you can talk about that. You can talk about the benefits this has brought in terms of economic output and health and knowledge and body height and any number of things, democracy and rights and all kinds of the wonderful things Steven Pinker talks about in Enlightenment Now and so on. You can have a very upbeat narrative. You can also talk, as many historians do, and rightly so, about the negative consequences of this transformation, about the legacies of colonialism that have fostered international inequality that is very much with us, legacies of racism, of any kind of discrimination, and of course the environmental fallout that the mobilization of fossil fuels has generated that we are only now beginning to understand just how terrible this might be in the future. So you have a very optimistic story and a very bleak story, and they're two sides of the same coin. And if you look at what actually goes on, what people write about, there is a tendency to privilege one or the other. It's very difficult to produce a kind of properly integrated history that looks at all these various elements without using one to excuse the other, right? Because there are also ideological preferences tightly tied up with these different perspectives. You can do this in a very boring way in a textbook, but if you want to do this in a more interesting fashion, that's a very, very difficult thing to do, especially in contemporary society, which tends to become more and more polarized, which we see in the political process, in the educational establishment, and so on. So my idea, and maybe that's too bold an idea, but the idea is to continue in a way on this trajectory and come up with a more integrated history that tries to make sense of this trade-off between all the benefits this transformation has engendered and the sometimes very terrible legacies that are still with us as a result of this transformation, and how historians should look and evaluate this process and these various trade-offs. So that's a very big project, and it's going to take a lot of time, but I hope to tackle this in the coming years.
Well, I absolutely cannot wait to see how that turns out, and I look forward to chatting with you again in the future. The book is Escape from Rome, The Failure of Empire and the Road to Prosperity. Everybody, go pre-order it right now. I promise you, you will get some meaningful things out of it. Professor Scheidel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.